We're back. I'm Paula Gordon. Bill Russell and I are talking with David Orr. We are sitting on the campus of Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio, where the Great Awakening, being led by Charles Finney, who was the founder of Oberlin College, had to do with personal salvation, but it was in the context of slavery and the debate about slavery. So as you bring up the subject of slavery, you are in a place where not only did they think about it, they did something about it. Is there a similarity here?
Oh, I think there is. This institution was the first to accept African Americans in the 1830s and the first to accept women. And that's part of the cultural ethos. That's part of our moral capital in this institution. When you think about how this applies to the 21st century, this place spoke to the conditions, the big issues of the time, and in particular servitude and justice questions of the 19th century. In the 21st century, all of those issues, I think, will be directly or indirectly tied to big global issues. Climatic change, we mentioned the loss of species, the loss of opportunity and income distribution, and those kinds of things. But there's a parallel. And the parallel, in part, is the arguments once made for slavery, and there were essentially four of them, made for slavery, are parallel in every way, almost indistinguishable from arguments for doing nothing about climate change. There are arguments of efficiency and rightness and so forth, but there are parallel arguments. And so when I drafted an article published back in the spring called 2020, A Proposal to Become Climatically Neutral, I'm trying to think in that article, how do we think about climatic change? What will this appear like to our children or great-grandchildren off in the future? We like to frame the argument in our political context now as, well, it's an economic issue, or it's a technical issue, or it's something else. And in my perspective, this is an argument about servitude, intergenerational remote tyranny. It's an argument about slavery, how much we will encumber future generations. How much debt will they have to pay? What conditions will they have to live in? And so in trying to think about this issue, for me, it becomes a form of intergenerational tyranny.
I was really struck. Bill McDonough last night was saying, and I had not thought about this, that we are the seventh generation from Thomas Jefferson.
That's perspective.
And what will happen seven out? I mean, all of a sudden, it kind of collapses the sense of time. He was talking about a whole different set of issues, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness at a distance from remote tyranny. I don't think I got that quite right, but I'm close. These issues look very short-term, and, of course, in America in particular, we have a challenge with short-term thinking. But do we have the will? Can you give us the hope to be looking toward not just the poetic, but the real seventh generation, and we are it from TJ.
You know, I heard a corporate seminar once in which a corporation was trying to become a sustainable corporation, and they were having kind of a hard time thinking through what they were going to do. And after hemming and hawing for several days, one of the vice presidents in the corporation said, "You know what's wrong with this company?" There was a long pause. And he said, "You know, we suffer from a deficit of joy." Now, that's interesting, because what he did was take a spiritual word, joy, combine it with an economic word, deficit, to say he was not having any fun. And he couldn't justify who he was is by what he did. And you think about the life that we have. Oftentimes, it's embedded in organizations where there isn't any fun. It's compulsive. It's economic behavior. And I think the sense of joy, and I want to use this building as an illustration, but the sense of joy that we have in what we do, we think of jobs. Well, jobs is a four-letter word, and it's sometimes lousy employment, but it's a living. Can't we think of a better world in which what we do becomes closely aligned with who we want to be and what we really are at our best? Now, I think the crisis of sustainability has a lot to do with the fact we don't have much fun anymore. We've got this deficit of joy. Illustration on this building. One of the nice things about the challenge of doing this particular project was working with a great team, Bill McDonough and Amory Lovins and John Todd and John Lyle and Carol Franklin and 18 or 20 folks who worked on this particular project. And there came to be a sense of real esprit. pride in what we did. Was it always fun? No, it wasn't always fun, but it sure was satisfying. And we knew, not designing a perfect building, but it was a very good building. It was a project that was worthy to do in every respect. And I don't think that we've developed a society where we have much fun anymore, where we don't have large challenges anymore. And I think in the 21st century, there ought to be a marriage on one hand with all these big crises and so forth, and somehow a different sense of livelihood that begins with lives worth living, and where service becomes a part of that, and joy and fun in lots of ways, and to take on challenges. If there was one message on this project that I would like to pass on to young people, was kind of go for it. If you feel it, if you have that kind of intuitive sense that something's right, go do it. I mean, make sure your sense is right, but have fun in life, and don't worry about making money and so forth. Another way to say this, and my dad was a Presbyterian preacher, and so I can say this with some authority, to go out and find a calling, because you can always, if you get the calling first, you can always find a career by which you can pay the bills. But if you try to have a career first and then somehow later get a calling, you've got the cart and horse in the wrong relationship. Life doesn't work nearly as easy.
We started out talking about the pedagogical predicate. What an institution could do and should do. And we tend to think of that in terms of words. We tend to think of pedagogy, learning. You know, I talk, you listen, or we both talk, and we listen to one another. And what this building represents, and I think a good part of what your work represents, I think, is the other 90%, which is the do, not the talk. And the learning that goes on would seem is, and you've got an experiment here in that. The learning, it would seem, comes from the participation, the engagement in the physical and the biological world you inhabit.
You know, Alfred North Whitehead, once the great mathematician and philosopher, wrote a little book on education in the 1920s, and he said he wasn't sure whether the brain was connected to the hand or the hand connected to the brain, which came first, but he was sure that the relationship was intimate and it was reciprocal. And if you think of how we do education now, we assume that education starts at the neck and works up and then only deals with half of that. And
that's not very limiting.
That's not how we live. I mean, there's not one of your listeners out there whose brains are disconnected from hands and feet and feelings. I mean, we are sensuous creatures. We like to do things. We like to make things. We learn best by doing. And that's always been the case. And I think in an academic setting, that's why I think biology classes tend to have high esprit and rapport, because oftentimes they're out in the field, they're out in the wetlands or in the woods or out on the seashore. They're doing things or making things. And so I think a pedagogy formed around active participation in life, and preferably where possible, doing something productive. We've got a group of students here that last spring worked on a project to redevelop the downtown here in Oberlin. And that was a good project. And it continues on to the present. So there's some connection between the future of the downtown, hopefully, and a learning process here. And there are all kinds of ways to connect that with agriculture and forestry, but where young people are actually beginning to do things. And you think of this is how we work as species.
This also serves to overcome a great bane of academia, which is theory versus practice.
May I give a little play off this? Oberlin has a seal. Everybody has a seal. You have to have one to be an institution. And the motto of this place is learning and labor. Isn't that some of what you're talking about?
Well, it is, and I think that it's an old idea, and it has a kind of cute, quaint, rustic sound to it.
1835 or whatever.
Right. And the idea was you would make better Christian young people and so forth in that old 19th century version of the word if they were disciplined. An idle mind was the devil's workshop and all that, so we're going to keep people busy.
But that's not a bad idea. It's just maybe that one of those that needs to be dusted off.
You know, Western culture is funny in this way, because Adam and Eve, by our lights, were kicked out of the garden and forced to spend the rest of their lives working. And so we see work as a curse. And why is work a curse? I mean, why work is how we make ourselves. And in Hindu notions of work is an active agent of self-transformation. That we start out as kind of a crude block of marble, and work is how we chisel out our true stature. And so it should not be a curse. I come from that kind of Presbyterian background, so work is important in my own makeup. But I think that why is work a curse? You know, why isn't work a joy and fun? And part of this is educational, I think. We need a more expansive definition of how we make our livelihood and personhood in the world. And we can play a part in that in education, but that's also a cultural problem.
We are also, I think, you know, as you've said and the people here have said, we also are blessed with some major challenges, which means that the work we, you know, there's the opportunity to find a great deal of satisfaction in the work we do.
Come back to those challenges in just a second. This is David Orr. Bill Russell and I are with David Orr in the Lewis Environmental Center's building in Oberlin, Ohio. Let us all come back in just a moment. Please be with us.